couple of times before. I love her enthusiasm for the program, and I'm going to let her tell her story, so I'll give you Linda at this time.
Good morning. My name is Linda. I'm a grateful member of the Ridgewood, New Jersey Al-Anon group, and I'm very glad to be here this morning. I love it when you say that back. I need you this morning as much as I have needed you every single 24 hours of my life. I'm glad that I didn't get any introduction. It gives me a chance to tell you my own story, kind of my own way. I think you'll find out, for those of you who get too hot and want to leave early, that this is a story of a jackass who got better in Al-Anon. So if you want to go early, that's it in a nutshell. Well, how did I get here? I wasn't always an Al-Anon member, certainly, and I wasn't always grateful, and so I think it's best to begin at the beginning. And I think that as a child, I probably was what everybody today would call well-adjusted. I had two very loving parents who made it quite clear that they liked each other and loved each other, and they also made it very clear that they loved us. I had two older sisters and a younger brother. And I think that as a kid, I enjoyed, let's say, the privilege of being supported in just about everything I did. So I can't claim that I started out bad and, you know, and found my way into Al-Anon. I started out as a happy child with a great deal of, I think, zest for living. And that was supported by my parents, who, by the way, didn't drink, so alcoholism was not a part of my early life. And I think that's an extraordinary privilege for a kid. It is. But that doesn't mean I didn't have little pits in my jello. I mean, I know some things about myself. As a kid, I really didn't like being alone very much. And I was the neighborhood playwright. You know, my mother not only encouraged me, she made scenery and little costumes, and I was periodically writing these little plays, and we'd have these neighborhood events. Of course, I would write the best parts for myself, but I know that about myself. I was already destined to want to stand up at the front of the band. That's where I wanted to be. I know I was like that at 8 or 9. And I also know that I loved people and I loved being around them. I loved the sound of laughter. I loved the sound of applause. And so I was, you know, at 8 a big people pleaser. And I know something else about myself. At 15, when I grew up, and I was a little late growing up, I noticed boys. I mean, I noticed them. I wanted nothing more than to be around them. I mean, this was the next set of people I was going to please because I liked the sound of those deep voices. I liked those square shoulders. I mean, I was turned on to young men. Now, I'll tell you something else. I was a bit chubby. I had two, I felt were very good-looking sisters. And I tell this story because it's very apparent that it shaped the lives of the people in my family. When only once, but I remembered it, my sisters remembered it, my father introduced us to somebody, and he was standing on one side of the room, and he had his arm around each of the two of my two sisters, and he said, you know, this is Sandy, and this is Judy, and aren't they pretty? And he put his hands under their chin. And then he kind of came across to where I was standing, and he put his arm on my shoulder, and he said, and this is Linda, she's the clever one. Now, my older sister is in college today, because she remembered that day, too, you see. I always wanted to be the pretty ones, and they always wanted to be the clever one. And, you know, we were all pretty, and we were all clever, but we took this, you know, we just held on to this. Now, this is a nice daddy. I mean, you know, this was not a mean and unpleasant man. But it shaped us, and it shaped our vision of ourselves. so that when I got to be 15 and I wanted to be around men, I mean, I knew I already had one strike against me. Now, I'm talking about being raised in the late 40s and 50s, going to school and high school in the late 40s and 50s, and you were not supposed to be clever. This was no-no for a girl if you wanted to get a guy. You were supposed to be clever when he asked to borrow your homework. But other than that, you were not supposed to be clever. You were supposed to be pretty. And if you were pretty, you could have anything you wanted. It's true, right? So this was my vision of men, and of course I was going to have to shape up. Now, how was I going to do? Well, I resolved to be good old Linda. You know the type, the Eve Arden of high school, always with the wisecrack, make everybody laugh, listen to everybody. I was the conversationalist, and pretty soon I had a lot of male friends. I didn't have boyfriends, because they wanted my sister's telephone number, but I did have some men around me, and you know, that made me feel comfortable. I pleased this whole set, the deep-voiced set I was after. So you just remember those pits, because those needs of mine shaped how I became when the disease of alcoholism came into my household. Because you see, those are the negative things in my life. Now there were some very positive things. I'm not bragging on myself when I'm saying I was clever, because I don't mean that. I mean that, yes, I found a great deal of stripes and strokes from being smart. If I got an A, my father said I was bright, and my mother thought I was wonderful, and so I tried to achieve so that people would think, that I was something. But I got this all mixed up, you see, being and doing, I got all mixed up. So, of course, the first day that I met Mr. Wright, I met him at college. I mean, I'd gone to college, right? Now, in the 50s, you went to college to get a husband. You're laughing. That's why we went. I mean, why else spend all that money? I mean, it was an investment in your future, right? Mr. Wright was going to walk into your life, and you were going to go on, to heaven together. And so I ended up going to St. John's University in Brooklyn. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. And, that's New York for those who don't know where Brooklyn is. Everyone from Brooklyn knows, everybody knows where Brooklyn is. So I went to St. John's University because I wanted to be a lawyer. After all, I was on my clever career, right? And I thought if I took myself to St. John's, I would also find someone that, some man, too, that wanted to share my life with me, on a college level, on an intellectual level. So I went to St. John's University. Well, I had two strikes against. One, it was a Roman Catholic university, and I was a Protestant. Any Protestants who go to Roman Catholic universities know that lunchtime is conversion city, right there. You don't get to eat unless you promise you'll think about converting. And the other strike was that your life is very structured, at least in those days. I mean, they had you sit alphabetically. I mean, you couldn't just go and sit down and be with somebody you wanted to be with. You had to sit next to somebody whose name began with the same letter in the alphabet. It was a kind of segregation. I don't know. I never sat with any of the A's, so I don't know. Maybe they were bad people. Because they always fix it that I sat right in the middle with the L's and the M's. And next to me in class, in several classes, was this white-skinned, dark-haired, blue-eyed Irishman who just knocked me off my pins. But of course he was way beyond me. I mean, I knew that as good old Linda, I was going to be in the group that was having fun, but I didn't think that I was going to be in his sphere of influence other than as a friend. And he was a very good friend. Now all this time, I had no experience, really no experience with alcohol or alcoholism. And you can say, well, how could you go to college and not have any experience? How could you go all through high school and not? I didn't. You see, I didn't like to drink. I didn't like the taste of it. I didn't like being out of control. I wanted to be in control. And if I had a drink of beer, that was disgusting. That was like, and scotch and all that stuff, people kept saying, well, you have to try this and you have to try that. Try beer with salt. Do I'll try beer with salt.
You know, it was beyond me how anyone could be an alcoholic. How could you ingest all that stuff? And scotch, you know, someone said to me, well, try scotch on the rocks. That was like drinking my father's hair tonic. It's true. It was beyond me why anybody would put that stuff in their mouth, you know, and then go have a good time. I could have a good time without that. Already told you I was a show-off. I still am. That's okay. I understand that about myself. But, you know, if you wanted to dance on the table, I didn't have to get drunk to do it. Okay, let's get up, you know. I mean, and I knew drinkers were the pit. First of all, when you was a kid and you had to travel on the subways, you know, a drunk was threatening. Somebody stagger into the car or somebody stagger into you on the street, that was a threat. What is that person going to do? How's that person going to hurt me? I mean, I was smart enough to be afraid of drunks. And because my parents didn't drink, I mean, they had an occasional cocktail or two, but they weren't drinkers as I know them to be today. I mean, so I went to school, and the boys who were in trouble with booze, everybody knew. I mean, while I was taking off my shoes to go out and dance, 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 the real drinkers were throwing up in my shoes. I mean, that was I didn't have to have any part of that whole scene. I mean, good old Linda was having a good time without it. Now, I sit down next to this gorgeous guy, and I haven't a hope of impressing him, but I have a prayer. This guy seems to like me. Boy, I never felt so lucky in my whole life, because everybody knew this was a handsome man. And I didn't think of myself as worthy. Great big pit in the jello. Stick it in there in college. I never thought I was worthy. I just thought I was lucky. Now, all those conversations at the lunch table are beginning to strike home. I'm beginning to listen now, because I'm interested in a Roman Catholic who's interested in me. And I heard all about the Roman Catholic faith, which is very close to my own. I was an Episcopalian. Very close, except this business with the Pope. Now, if I could just get over the business with the Pope, you know, I could have a whole new religion. And I began to hear things that appealed to me. You know something? I knew that the best thing in the world for me would be to convert to Roman Catholicism and marry John in the Roman Catholic faith, because, not because I wanted to bring up my children, you know, with one common faith, although that might have been part of it because my parents had a mixed marriage, but because Roman Catholics never got divorced. Now, I knew that if I became a Roman Catholic, I could say to that man, gotcha. Isn't it true? I mean, if you're not really pretty and you haven't brought the boys in with your face and you gotta be clever, I mean, you get tired. You can't always be clever. You can't always give in. You can't always say you're right and defer. So there's got to be something to hold that all together, and why not faith? And they promised me something else, too, at those lunch tables. You know, I was going to go to heaven. Sorry about the rest of you, but if I joined that faith, I had a sure thing. I was going to go to heaven with a husband. We were going to go together forever and ever and ever. Now, with that kind of security, I mean, you can relax a little. I have to tell you, there were several things about this man that excited me, besides his looks, because I don't want you to think that I was just overcome by that. He was my friend. He seemed to accept me.
I could talk and have opinions that he seemed to be interested in. And I loved that in him. He seemed to respond to me warmly. I mean, I knew how I was responding to him. But you know, that excited me, the possibility that I was going to have a partner. You know, I wouldn't have to be alone in life and life's hardships. I wouldn't have to have those nagging feelings you have when you're a teenager that, you know, what's my future going to be like? You know, all those things would be settled for me. I was going to have a loving partner, companion, and we were going to go through life together, you know, us against the world kind of thing. And that excited me, and it made me comfortable. And it also made me very demanding. You see, I don't think that I married for money. I know I didn't marry for money. Okay, I suppose I have middle-class values, those I was stuck with, and maybe I expected to live at that level. But not, I didn't expect to live high. I just hoped that we could have kids and that we could be able to send them to the dentist and be able to send them to the doctor if they needed to go, and they could have the shoes they needed and things like that. And that's what I hoped. And, you know, we started with the children. We did get married, and we did start with the children, you know, pretty much right away. We had 7 children. That part we got right. I don't know whether or not the expression of all that we were doing, you know. Anyway, soon enough, we moved away from both my family and his family. And that, I thought, was a great beginning, you know, to be kind of out on our own and facing life together. Oh, and I liked that together. I started out real early with that together. Nobody went out alone. After all, we'd made this partnership, right? So we went together. But I thought that was okay. I didn't realize that it might have been stifling, but I liked that. But I noticed very soon after we were married, that there were moods and things I couldn't handle. You see, we never tested anything in that sense before we were married in terms of our own self. I was so anxious to please this man and to be the right person for him that I don't think that I ever consciously bucked. I just deferred. You see, people who make deferments to other people understand that the natural result is a big fat resentment very quickly, soon. I was filling with resentments. And something else was changing. There were these periods where alcohol seemed to be very important. Now, I understood that. Just because I didn't want to drink didn't mean someone else couldn't drink. And, you know, I wasn't too shocked by an occasional, let's say, drinking too much. I didn't notice that. What I noticed was that we weren't getting along and that there was a lot of anger. Now, of course, I always pointed to his anger because his anger was open and loud. My anger was building way down deep inside of me because, you see, if I let my anger out straight away early and said, you know, I don't like that, I'm not going to do it, that's tough, I don't care, do whatever you want. I never had that kind of expression because I thought, if I did, A, I wouldn't be able to please, B, I would be alone. So I was never honest. You know, I'd smile. You know. I had to be the good one because then I could point out he was the bad one and something would change. So that's what I noticed. I didn't notice the disease of alcoholism. What did I know? What did I know? Oh, I thought I knew everything. I mean, I was the best type wife anybody could have in this world.
I mean, I cleaned and I cooked, didn't I? No matter what the results were, but I did it, didn't I? And I had all these children, didn't I? I mean, I was always pregnant. But you see, it became the lesser of two evils. You know, at least when you get pregnant, you don't have to worry about getting pregnant anymore. True. I mean, and I was always worried about getting pregnant, so getting pregnant was easier. Then you didn't have to worry about it for 9 months. And I have to tell you, I love those babies. I mean, we had these 7 children in 10 years, so you know it was a lot. And we didn't have little bitty babies. 3 of them were over 10 pounds. I mean, I brought home these hulking brutes. And they needed to be big and strong because, you know, they had to fight for the crib. A pregnant woman. How can anybody be unkind? Can't you see the condition I'm in? I mean, it's finally occurred to me that I probably went on and had all those children. Besides the fact that I have to tell you that natural bonding I had right away. Those little brand new faces, my God, how they caught me. I mean, I never minded. You know, I never minded the birthing of them, the carrying of them. I only minded other people not treating me like I was some kind of saint because of it. See, I had no resentments against the children. I mean, they were too little to know better, but the big people, they could have straightened out. Now, the one big person in my life who was supposed to help out with this growing sea of towheads, you know, was disappearing into himself. Oh, he was there, but he was disappearing. There was no way I could appeal to who he was as a person. I remember early saying, help me, because I was so depressed, but I didn't understand. I never understood why. I never understood how this positive, super thing of being with this man that had so much on the ball and was so dear. How did this happen? I mean, I always thought of myself as a piece of sunshine. I did. And everything was clouding over. You know, not so as you'd notice right away. I mean, a big thunderstorm you can do something about, but this going down hill, piece by piece. You know, I never understood it. I didn't. I just knew I was beginning to change into somebody I never wanted to be. I was an angry, lonely, alone person. You can be that way and have 7 children, because, I mean, you're busy. Right? Now comes the waiting. You're waiting for him to come home. All 7 children and you are waiting for him to come home. I don't care what time it is, we're waiting. You need lunch? You need something to wear? You can't find your shoes? Can't you see I'm busy? You know the routine at the window. The curtains with the natural little fold. Your spiritual life, I mean, we all know what your emotional life is like, but your spiritual life, now you're beginning to talk to God in a kind of nasty frame. First, you start out nice. Oh, dear God, right? Oh, dear God, please let him come home. God, you notice? Please let him come home.
God let him come home.
Please don't let him be hurt.
Let him be hurt.
Oh, not dead. Not dead, not right away. Sorry. I had to have the body on the couch. I had to have the body in the house. It made me feel comfortable. Lay it out in the bed. I could be comfortable. Can't go to sleep without that body in the bed. Hate him, love him, love him, hate him, but bring him home, put him in the bed. Because I couldn't tolerate it, because I couldn't live with it, because I didn't have what it took to live without it. You see, when you put yourself, heart and mind, into another person's body, you become them. They are part of you. I understand that kind of obsession. I'm a master at that kind of obsession. See, I didn't want him to be rich. I only wanted one thing from him. I only ever wanted one thing from him. I wanted his soul. I never thought I was demanding. Well, now what do you do? You, when you're in your home and you haven't got what it takes to get what you want or even need on your own, you have to go from this spirit into this one. It was a very natural thing for me to move upstairs. That's what I did. I moved in up here. And naturally up here, I was single. And naturally up here, sweet men loved me, wanted me. So I spent my time not watching anymore. I spent my time purposefully making up little plays about me in my head. You want lunch? You want to find your shoe? I'm busy. And I began to daydream about the perfect life I was going to lead while I moved through the day doing the things I needed to do to survive. But I was a very moral person. I mean, I'd had two religions. So when I moved up there, I had to move John out. I mean, you couldn't have, you know, I wouldn't do that. So then I had to plan how he'd move out. Well, let's see, the best way would be to have someone else move him out for me. So I began to imagine what it would be like when the state trooper came in his little cute jodhpurs and his hat to tell me that John had bit the dust on the road. I mean, I planned it. I acted it out. When everybody would go to school, I'd sneak to the front door, and I'd pretend that the door would open and the patrolman would be there, and he would tell me, and I would slowly slide down the wall. Then I wrote a better play, and I would faint into the trooper's arms. Now, my head was beginning to be very full. I mean, I had the input from the day, the input from the seven children, the input from an occasionally drinking and very angry person, and my own input, and my head began to get so tight that I had probably the worst headaches I've ever had in my life. I remember one day, not to get attention, but genuinely being so in pain that I crawled out the front door across the lawn to get a neighbor. She took me to a doctor. The doctor gave me a shot, and I remember that I was lying on the table, and he leaned over my face. He said, "You know, this is not a physical headache, don't you?" Now, I knew that I would have to do something, but I was never the one to do something first. We became separated, not because I wanted to be separated. I just wanted to be separated, but I didn't want to be separated. We all know what that means. I had to have the... I just wanted it to stop. I wanted the badness, the negative business to stop. I didn't know it was connected with the drinking. This was wrong, and this was wrong, and this was wrong, and this was wrong, and oh yes, drink. I didn't know that the drinking was at the center of all of this. So it was other things and other people. It was always some other thing that was at the heart of this. Well, you can't separate people who aren't grown up and who have one soul. Even if that one soul is sick, it comes back together again because it can't be apart. We didn't come back together again resolved to make things different. We came back together again, phew. You know, phew. Well, at least we don't have to go through the pain of aloneness. But we didn't grow up. But there was an incident that made us aware of alcoholism. You see, I try very hard not to tell my husband's story, but this part of the story is my story, because you see, I was attached to him. All right, so if you just understand, I was attached to him, so he suffered, I suffered. I tell you, I thought I suffered equally. I thought I suffered more than he suffered when he suffered, whatever he was suffering, right? So I had my own suffering extra, so I had 1.5 doses of suffering. And I suffered terribly with this drinking incident and the car and the keys and people saying, you know, this was a bad incident, the car. God, nobody was hurt. But it did something inside of me. It did something that I hadn't done ever before. You see, people who talk a lot tend to look or sound opinionated. Having an opinion doesn't necessarily mean you're opinionated, and it certainly doesn't mean that you have strength in that opinion. Because you see, I knew something about myself, and that was that I vacillated. Oh my God, I was such a weakling. I would go back forth with anything. But after this incident, I'm seeing the results of it, you know, a really bad morning after. I said something like, you have to go to the doctor. If you don't go to the doctor, I'm going to have you put away, or I'm going to put you away. I couldn't have done that. And maybe that's not the reason he went to the doctor, but he did go to the doctor. And the doctor in our town was the head of a drying out place called Mount Carmel Guild in Paterson, New Jersey. Our town doctor. How many times have you heard of people just waiting to find the right doctor to take someone to? You know, we had him in our town. He was part of the group of doctors that, you know, were our family doctors. And we went down there, and he came out of that doctor's office, and he was suitably impressed, let me tell you. There were tears in his eyes, and he said to me, you know, this doctor thinks I'm an alcoholic. Well, now, wait a minute. Let's backtrack a little. I mean, I was not going to have one of those in my bedroom. You know, before I got married, my father said to me, there's just one thing I feel I must tell you. It's been my experience that the Irish drink. I was never so angry at anything in my life as hearing that. I mean, did my father honestly think I would choose somebody imperfect? I mean, I knew what I was doing. That was the relationship that I made. I picked is what I thought. And I couldn't have that be true. And when John said to me, after all this bitterness and pain, I'm an alcoholic, I said, oh, no. I did. Now, I want you to know that we were barely talking. At this period in our lives, we'd had a separation. There were a great many ugly words between us. I always felt that I should have been able to convince John, convince him with words, what he should be doing and how he should be acting. I mean, I really thought I should be able to convince him. And I hadn't managed it. I wanted to convince him that he was crazy. Because you see, then he could go and he, you know, he could go see the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist would talk to him about maturing. And then we'd have him. I'd have the body in the bed. I'd have the partner back again. I'd have everything I needed and wanted. Alcoholic. I mean, that was so beneath crazy. You know, we have our levels. We can't sink below these levels. So I give it to John. He was very generous. He was very generous. You know, he did give me 6 months to prove that the doctor was right and I was wrong. And about 6 months later, he threw in the sponge. And the doctor called the two guys from AA. I was very happy to see them at that point. First of all, they were very nicely dressed. They were well-spoken, they were very polite, but more to the point, I knew that when they took him wherever it was they were going to take him, they would bring him back to me. And I hadn't been sure of that for some time. I said I would gladly hold the door open for them to take him, you know, and get him fixed. Oh, I'd thought of that too. Something that was very interesting to me. My children say, you say interesting when you don't know what else to say. That's true. The third day or third evening, see, I think it was a Monday that they went out to the first meeting. So somewhere, maybe it was Tuesday, maybe it was the next night, one of the AA gentlemen said, you know, you ought to go to Al-Anon. Never heard of it in my life. I mean, I had just barely heard of AA. I remember my mother's grieving because a friend of hers, you know, was so bad that she had to go to AA. That's how my mother, oh, you know, really the end. Blessed. Went to AA. So I'd heard of AA. This gentleman didn't get the best response from me because, you see, I was very angry. Why should I have to go anywhere? This was the sick one. The one that they were carting back and forth, they got the right guy. I mean, there was no mistaken identity. This was the one. Take him out, fix him, get him well, and everything will be just fine here. Well, he was a salesman, and he knew that he'd definitely met some resistance, you see, because he'd made the mistake of telling me that alcoholism was an illness and that the entire family gets sick. When he used that word sick with me, I was very upset. I didn't want to hear anything more about it. So, you know, he just switched his spiel. He said, well, on the other hand, now you have to listen again, right? There's another hand. On the other hand, he said, you know, I can tell that you really love your husband. You know, not all wives, you know, I've met some people, they don't really love them, but I can tell you love your husband. And he said, you know, from our brief talk, I can tell that you're a very intelligent person and would like to do the best to help your husband recover from his illness, and that you'll do everything you can
help him. So I went. Now let me tell you something. I've heard so many people speak about that first Al-Anon meeting. You know, you walk through those doors, no matter how you feel, you walk through those doors, and you know you're home. Well, I hated every one of them. First of all, I compared myself to them. Another big pit in my jello. This is how I did it. They were smiling. They were laughing. They felt comfortable with one another. And the minute I saw that, I was angry because it made me understand that they didn't see. They weren't intelligent enough to understand the depth of this problem. They were obviously flighty people who simply hadn't suffered much. On top of that, while my mother had taught me to sew, and she certainly had really emphasized that a lady, you know, was put together, I walked into that room loaded down with little gold safety pins. There wasn't a strap, not a strap on my entire body, not a hem that wasn't held up with little gold safety pins. Now, you know, don't look at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. I call that pre-Al-Anon underwear. You know, it hangs at half mast. And it's always white for purity. And I noticed right away, you know, these people were taking turns talking. And when the women raised their hands, you know, the underarm seam on their blouses, you know, was fully sewn. So I didn't like them. I felt I had nothing in common with them. It's true. Very strange thing happened in those meetings, though. In spite of myself, when I went home, I felt better. I don't know what it was. I certainly wasn't willing. I'll tell you one of the things that helped. I read, right? I was clever, so I got everything. Read it all in a week. Do you know we must have 100 pamphlets and books? I read them all in a week, got them all out. Oh, I recognize him. Oh, yeah, he's got to fix that. Oh, he's really in trouble. Anything about alcohol, I read. It wasn't too long. Even though we were both in the program, that the same problems came up. And we separated. And this time I thought, I always thought that all of that was due to alcoholism. And I was willing. Wasn't I willing to go to Al-Anon and to learn how to live with this SOB until he got better in AA and I could stand to live with him again? Wasn't that virtuous? You see, I thought I was getting virtuous, so what was the matter with him? Now I began to really dislike AA. Oh, sure. It's just a replacement for the barroom. Sure, go down there and talk with your friends. What does it matter? We've got 8 windows broken here. And I would say to my Al-Anon friends, when is he going to? You never talked about that at an Al-Anon meeting? Right. Live one day at a time. Stupid. You know, that really was stupid. That part. Right away, I said, that's stupid. I mean, no one who's intelligent lives one day at a time. I had 2 years' worth of paydays marked off on the calendar. I'm now going to go from 2 years at a time to one day at a time. I mean, if you'd had a 1 year at a time slogan, I might have come in faster. I mean, I could cut down. Okay.
This is a program of self-recovery. But there are always four corners in every meeting. There are always four walls. There's always somebody who wants to stay sick. And if you want to stay sick, all you have to do is sit next to them and talk to them only. And don't kid yourself, there are four walls in an AA room too. So I sat in the corner with the people who were thinking about being good to yourself so that you could get him back. Right? You gotta dye your hair, you gotta lose weight, you gotta... The trouble with you, Linda, is you don't know how to do your eyebrows. Oh, I loved hearing that. I could fix my eyebrows. How was I going to fix this terrible time I was having with this person? You see, I only saw Al-Anon as this AA adjunct. I was going to just go there and be good old Linda. I didn't realize that I was in a great deal of trouble, that I'd lost the person I wanted to be. I didn't realize that. Growing up is hard to do. Breaking up is not hard to do. We broke up a lot. We came back together again. Coming back together again is hard to do. To make a long story short, we had a lot of these periods in our life where I concentrated on we instead of me. Now, I finally got it the last time when we were separated for a year and a half. I got it because God wanted me to have it. No other reason. I call my higher power God. And I didn't call him anything for a long time because I was mad at him. It's true. And I was mad at the people who talked about him. But the people who talked about him obviously didn't know anything about him at all. That's what I believed. I was very cynical. The people who talk, because you see, I talk. And I talk a good line. The only reason I forgive myself is that I was such a snob that I learned all that stuff in the books by heart. And I passed it on that way. I passed it on that way so people would think I was smart. But at least I didn't mess it up when I gave it away. I just didn't get it. No, I went a long time like this. I was in the program 8 years when we had this last separation, and I thought, well, by golly, I don't want to die. Every time I was alone, I thought I was going to die. The things I did, I always did so that we could stay together. Now, you slice that blob in two to make whole people, each in their own program, there's going to be a lot of blood. That's how I look at it. There was a lot of blood, a lot of wounds. Sometimes there's just not enough bandages in this lifetime to put those things back together again. And sometimes you're lucky and God gives you a little regenerative power that you never thought you had. But I know one thing. If I hadn't gone to Al-Anon on my knees, begging people to point me in a direction that would help me, I never would have lived. I would have bled to death because that's how I felt. I felt so much pain. But I went back. I went back. Reach a bottom, let's say that I reached another bottom. And I listened. And I'm not telling you that I got well right away. I really wish I could. I wish I could say, all you have to do is go and listen. I went and I listened, but you have to fight your own nature. You know, my nature was very powerful. It rejected good. It rejected reason. It rejected getting well. It loved being sick. It was so comfortable, sick, and it was at least not as bad as facing the fear of getting different. But when you really hurt and you have nothing else to escape to, you go to Al-Anon. Now, let me just say that there are a lot of people who think sometimes that I should have been grateful that my husband was sober. I was always grateful that my husband was sober. I was always more for him than I was for me anyway. I was very grateful. I knew it was a miracle. I knew that there are many people who don't get well, that never find sobriety. I never really ever, I don't think, felt bad about that. I don't know if I said, you're better when you drink. If I did, God forgive me. But I really thought that that was a wonderful thing for him. And I thought it was a wonderful thing for the family. I thought it was a wonderful thing for the children. It just never was enough. So going back to Al-Anon in this way sent me in the direction of work. I had a lot of part-time jobs. I always had a lot of part-time jobs, and I had to go to work. I wanted to go to work. I wanted to build something for myself so that I could be somebody. I could be somebody that I had wanted to be when I was younger. You know, now I was seven children's mother, right? Oh, this is my mother. You know. And since you didn't have a loved one to call your name, you begin to think you're nameless. It's not true, but that's what I thought. That I was nameless and without love. My skin ached to be touched. That's how the state I went in to work full time. And where did I go to work? I went to work at the Al-Anon Rural Service Office in New York City. Now, the first project, because I was a writer and been an English teacher, the first project that they gave me to edit and to write was a definitive fourth step inventory. Obviously, an AA started the laughing. It's like getting vitamins for free, right? I took inventories. I had always taken inventories in my Al-Anon meetings, but when you take a public inventory, if you're like me, you confess to something everybody already knows. You get to the 9 o'clock meeting at 20 after, on the week that your group is doing four-step inventory, you tell everybody you have trouble being on time. You just tell everybody what they already know about you. That's how to keep a hold of that nice, comfortable sickness, is just confess to the obvious. Now, you cannot write without thinking. If good writing is anything, it's the product of good thinking. And you cannot write questions for a fourth-step inventory if you don't think them. And for about 8.5 months, from 9 to 5, or thereabouts, I took my inventory. Now, I needed remedial inventory taken, and that's what I got. It took me as long as it took, really, to have any of those children. And at the end of that time, because I had managed to have a fifth step with somebody as well, I'm convinced of this. I'm absolutely convinced of this. You see, I was so sick, so cynical, so snobbish, so angry, so alone. This is what worked. I took a definitive fourth step inventory. I had a fifth step. I was coming home from work. I went up and over a trestle, and the commuter train pulled out, and I noticed something. I noticed that the sound of that train whistle didn't make me feel lonely. Literally pulled my head up, and I noticed that that pain in my skin was gone, and I was so struck. I heard this voice, and of course I know it was my own voice, I was talking out loud, but I heard my voice say, "Why, Linda, you can do this." And I was changed. I was turned around. I wasn't made 100% better. I had a miracle. I had a change in direction. I mean, it permeated my skin. I went home, the children knew something had happened. They said, what had happened to you? The visiting daddy noticed something. I began to want to tell the truth. I've been in Al-Anon for 8 years. I told the truth to this level. You know, and then after a couple of years when I figured people were not going to murder me, I could tell it at this level. I just wanted it to come from right up there and be the reason I was going to be somebody. I wanted to be different. I didn't want the same things in other people. I wanted different things for me. Now, it was a long, hard climb because I had wasted so much time. We did get back together again. That's a miracle, too. I know that if John had gone to his program and turned out to be Saint John, right, and I hadn't gone to Al-Anon, you know, he would have been Saint John the monk. He would have lived without me. If I had gone to Al-Anon and become, you know, that sanctified person, and that just means serene, trouble-free, positive, loving. That's what sanctity is. A safeness. It takes two people to have a relationship. I don't care what the relationship is. And if it's going to be a sexual and partnership one, you gotta have two whole people. You see, because I got married all full of all of those pits in my jello. And if you saw the spaces, when I wanted to marry John, I figured that when you got married, you fill them up like this, you see. And you became one whole person this way. And we had alcoholism in the family. And I had all my problems. And all of our negative things just made us look like this. There was no way we were going to complement one another without being whole. I needed Al-Anon. It was my miracle, and I needed it. I not only wanted it, and we all know now, I needed it. And I got it. Do I always remember that my life is not governed by what other people do and say? No, not always. But more than I ever used to. Am I always serene, understanding that with the help of a higher power, I can find comfort and safety in meditation? Not always, but I'm a lot better than I used to be. Do I always live one day at a time and not plan and project and not worry myself about things that I have no idea are going to happen? Do I drag up the past? Do I never do that? Not always. But I'm certainly better than I used to be. Am I always kind in service? Do I remember that I don't know everything and that other people would like to have a choice and would like to have some kind of input? Not always. But I'm so much better than I used to be. Do I want to keep coming to Al-Anon forever? You better believe it. This stuff works. I mean, look at me. Will you always let me come to a meeting? I sure hope so. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. I enjoyed it. So many of the feelings we all share, I'm certain. I know I did, at least. And on behalf of the committee, we do have a gift for you. Thank you. very much. I didn't thank the committee for asking us, and that man, John, did come with me. And still, I just want to stand up and see the cute Irishman, John. Just like to say this to the committee, because I know what it takes to put on an event like this. You know, here we have 300 and some children that you have to provide for, and I'm extremely grateful. And I wanted to say especially thanks to